So a bit behind the scenes, obviously me and Matt are recording, we're looking at each other, and the other day when we were recording our Ink Master episode, I noticed something very peculiar in Matt's office. He has a big coffee machine and pretty much drank the entire container of coffee. How much fucking coffee do you drink a day?
I drink one of those when I'm ever at work. Sometimes two, depending.
So what, that's like, that's 2 liters of coffee?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I have ADHD, right? So my brain processes stimulants differently.
You're telling me.
So basically, my brain doesn't work like your puny neurotypical one.
I have ADHD as well, and I can't even take the fucking medication. What are you talking about?
To be fair, I have drunk a lot less coffee since I started taking 54 milligrams of speed every day.
You're on the Black Beauties.
Yeah. Slow release.
Yeah, the joys of Dexedrine. You're very welcome to Beneath the Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. I'm one of your hosts, Thomas O'Mahony, and I'm joined, as ever, by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matt Lauder.
Bonjour. The other thing, actually, speaking of medication, I didn't mention this, actually, on the Ink Master recording, but in the middle of the... one of the joys of watching Ink Master through an American VPN is that you get American adverts, which often include like pharmaceutical ads, right? And the first advert that I got in Ink Master told me to stop typing and call a registered urologist now.
Hey, they know you're 42.
Exactly. So I was like, this is fucking apt. Ink Master and this podcast, increasingly, Tom, is driving me to urinary tract infection. slash prostate cancer. I don't know.
This is very, very severe. This is the consequences of becoming a podcaster. It happened to Jordan Peterson, except he got addicted to Benzedrine and barbiturates.
I thought he was already addicted to benzos, and it was him coming off them that was the problem. Wasn't that the thing?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't really know.
let's keep it that way.
Yeah. Today we are actually revisiting something that we talked about briefly in one of our like very, very early episodes last year, but it's something that I think we should pay a bit more attention to because it's a really, really interesting story. And today we're talking about Akibala, the Altai princess.
Yeah, well, this is a story that is in Painted People, but we haven't talked about very much on the podcast. We've been talking a lot about 19th and 20th century stuff. So good moment to mention this. I mean, I was also talking about this, as we'll come to later on, in the context of kind of contemporary museum politics as well, because there's some interesting recent developments that are not straightforwardly to do with the tattoos, but to do with the sort of what could be called necropolitics in the academic literature of this particular preserved mummified body. Presumably you'd see, had you heard of this woman or her body before? Because when one thinks about mummified tattooed remains from history, obviously Ötzi, who we've talked about, is the one that comes to mind often, but this particular woman who listeners may have heard of being called the Ice Maiden or the Ukok Princess or the Altai Princess, she has a number of names which we'll talk about. If people have heard of her, she'd become quite infamous.
Had
you heard of her before?
I had seen pictures of her remains. I didn't understand the context that they were in at the time. Obviously I do now. Like it might have been one of those like listicles that was like, oh, you know, ancient tattoos, that sort of thing, but wasn't overly familiar with the story and definitely wasn't familiar with the kind of, you know, politics around it now.
Yeah. So
There's been there was an interesting paper published a couple of years ago by a Russian archaeologist, Sergei Mikhailovich Slepchenko, along with a couple of Korean archaeologists, Jung Ha Hong and Dong Hoon Shin. And they kind of lay out the rough history of Siberian mummies. And they do sort of say, quote, despite the academic works of Siberian mummies over the past decades, except for the Pazaric mummy, Siberian ice maiden in the Ukok Plateau, the academic achievements are not well known to the outside world. So this particular body, who they also call a mummified female that made a huge impact all over the world, she's one of a lot of mummies, increasingly large number of mummified bodies that have been discovered across basically the Arctic bits of Russia, but we're going to talk particularly today about her. As ever, we recommend listeners who are interested in this topic to pick up Aaron Dieter Wolf's edited collection, Ancient Ink, which has some more detail on this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And also for anyone listening, maybe check out the episode we did with Dr. Anne Austin a couple of months ago about her work in Egypt, and you'll get more of an understanding of why we have these kind of problems with finding preserved bodies with tattoos. To give a kind of condensed history, essentially the reason why we find tattooed remains in places like in the Alps where Otzi was found, in Egypt with mummies there, and in this case with Akipala, the Altai princess, is in most regions of the world, the remains of the dead decompose quite quickly. So in kind of arid regions like in Egypt, in places like the Altai Plateau, where bodies are placed in the permafrost, those are kind of preserving and naturally mummifying the bodies. So ergo, it preserves the tattoos as well.
Yeah, exactly right. So maybe the best place to start, right, is from the moment of the discovery of this body, which happened in 1994. So we're talking, as will become important later on, post Soviet Russia, like in the sort of five or so years after the fall of the Soviet Union, well, fall of the Berlin Wall. This Russian archaeologist by the name of Natalia Polosmak, who is really the kind of, you know, early expert on this, is leading this archaeological expedition in a part of the Russian Federation, basically on the corner of Russia, China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan. Southern border of Siberia, in a autonomous republic of Altai. And so this is also one of the reasons she gets called the Altai princess, is because that's the region she's from. The other geographic feature is the Ukok Plateau. So this 7,500-foot high tundra, basically, up in the Siberian wastes. And I'll read from Paul Samak's article she wrote for National Geographic quickly. So, at summer's end, we wrenched her from the cold earth. We lifted the body of the woman from her casket, eased it onto a stretcher, and covered it with white gauze, pinning the edges of the cloth like the wings of a specimen butterfly. Six of my students, serving as pallbearers, hefted the stretcher onto their shoulders, and then they carried her across the alpine meadow from the false eternity of the 2,400-year-old tomb into a plywood hut. I knew she was an important person, for six elaborately harnessed horses lay sacrificed against the solid timbers of her luxurious burial chamber. I simply called her the Lady. Her robe was soft and pliant. The objects that surrounded her, made of wood, horn, felt, and leather, were the implements of everyday life that rapidly deteriorate in most graves. We'd intercepted a suspended moment. Time travelled to an ancient tableau so perfectly intact, we could literally smell her last symbolic meal of mutton, unfinished on a low wooden table by her side. In the years ahead, we will write the next chapters on the Pazaric culture. And again, as foreshadowing, with recent advances in DNA testing, we can begin to clarify the origins of the early horsemen on the Eurasian steppes. Right. So this is a Russian archaeological team from St. Petersburg, if I'm not mistaken. Well, actually, from Novosibirsk is where the Institute of Archaeology is. Who is uncovering or working in this indigenous region far, far at the eastern edges of the empire or former Russian empire. It is a place, apparently Ukok, the local people tell Possumak, means the end of everything. These pastures lie within the second layer of heaven, a step above ordinary people and events. It's a sacrilege to shout here because it would offend the spirits. And in fact, the title of the article in National Geographic, when this is first revealed to the world, is called "A Mummy Unearthed from the Pastures of Heaven." So what they're doing, and this was also becomes controversial, is basically like pouring. So the Pazaric people are a part of a transcontinental group called the Scythians, or who the Greeks called the Scythians, who are essentially who the Dothraki in Game of Thrones were based upon, right? Mm-hmm. They're an interconnected group of nomadic horse-riding people who live basically across the Russian continent from, or the Russian part of the continent, from the Middle East, from China and the Silk Road, all the way up into the almost into the kind of upper parts of the Greek Empire. They were phenomenally skilled horsemen. They are also said to be the origin in Greek mythology for the Amazons, because there were particular tales of women warriors as part of some Scythian groupings. But the Pazaric are this specific group that lived in this part of eastern Siberia. And as global warming has increased, as climate change has occurred, the burial mounds, so they're called kurgans, of the important members of Pazaric society have become revealed, right? So the ice has been melting. And essentially, this burial kurgan, this burial tomb, had become visible. And Polsamak's team basically began doing more active archaeological digging, or actually less so digging and more literally using boiling water to melt the ice. And as she describes, like, so kind of poetically there, that this woman had been buried in such a way that there was a kind of sacrificial offering of some kind, or a final meal of meat and of herbs. And literally, as they poured water onto this ice that had been frozen since, so we're talking 2400, about 277 BCE. As they poured the hot water onto this ice and it thawed, the smell of like that last meal, which had frozen very, very quickly after she was buried, became like, sort of filled their noses. Really, really amazing.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well that in this story as well, part of the reason why her remains were so well preserved was the fact that someone was buried on top of her as well.
That's right. So obviously over the millennia, many of these kurgans that had already been revealed had been grave robbed, right? And in fact, again, we can straight away from Polsamak's article quote on this. "We removed the surface rocks from the kurgan and I see the remains of a big hole in the corner that had been looted. When we dug the next day, we came upon a shallow coffin made of wood and stone. Inside was a skeleton, a body that had been buried in the top of the kurgan above the Pazaric chamber. It was a man interred with three horses not long after the first burial. It was his grave that had been looted, not the ladies." So basically this, as we're going to talk about, this particular important Pazaric woman had been, her burial chamber had been used again, perhaps even as an act of desecration by a rival culture, for another grave, maybe you know, soon, or even maybe just some centuries later. And it was when grave robbers over at some point in the intervening centuries like found that place, they took everything that was there and didn't bother looking underneath it. So presumably over the intervening period, as anyone else came, they'd see it was already empty, right? There was literally only like kind of boat. There was a skeleton, some horse skeletons, and a kind of iron knife, sort of useless iron knife, basically. And so, yeah, this is exactly what allows the Ochibala, the Altai princess, to her body to survive so well into the 21st century. I mean, I have to say there have been other members of this cultural group, both men and women, who have been discovered, but hers is certainly the most famous.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because this is definitely a part of the world where, when we think about, you know, before current era, like tattoo histories, it doesn't necessarily come up. But in terms of like the descriptions of the Scythians that come from, you know, Greek historians and other like accounts that we have from the past, they are like described as like painted people.
Right. And so that's a good move on to talk about the tattoos here, because like, again, I want to quote from this first National Geographic article, because it does give a real sense of what's going on here. So she says, the casket is, so we poured hot water. The broth formed and filled the air with a foul odor of meat that had begun to rot before it froze. It was the last meal intended to sustain the lady in the afterlife. There was a wooden vessel whose handle was the carved image of two cats with a wooden stirrer and the remains of a dairy product, maybe yogurt. There are these horses, and you know, you have to, if you imagine being buried with sacrificed horses, must already give you a sense of her status, because you wouldn't kill like your good horses for no reason.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly like a nomadic culture that is renowned for their, you know, horse riding ability.
Yeah. And so as the body is uncovered, Apostle Max says, "Would I find a skeleton or a corpse or a mummy? Scythians and Pazariks sometimes mummified their dead. The body was gutted, the skull split, and the brain removed, the muscle scraped away. The remains are embalmed with an aromatic mixture of herbs, grasses, and wool, and the skin sewn back together. At 10:35 on Monday morning, something emerged through the ragged edges of a hole in the ice, a bare jawbone, but with the flesh of a cheek intact. That afternoon, a shoulder appeared, covered by a fur blanket. I peeled back the fur to reveal flesh, not bone, and a brilliant blue tattoo of a magnificent griffin-like creature. For a moment, I could only stare and grin, my mind churning. This was our gold, our loot." That tells you something. Yeah, right. We had a mummy, only the second tattooed Pazaric body ever to be found. The first from the second Kurgan of Rudenko. Rudenko is another Russian archaeologist from a previous generation of archaeologists, had mostly disintegrated in the centuries since its burial. It emerged from the ice like a temple rubbing. Okay. So we've got this woman's body emerging amongst this smell of meat and aromatic herbs in this very politically charged moment of Russian post-communist history. And all of a sudden, this beautiful tattooed hand reveals itself to the world. Now, so as you said, like, it was known from Greek sources in particular that the Scythians in general may have been tattooed, right? So from the 6th to the 3rd centuries BCE, we've got the Silk Road to Greece, through China, India, and Persia. All of these stories, both the Greeks, Chinese, the Persian writers, talk about, for example, this is from Hippocrates, Scythians who cauterized their shoulders, arms, and hands, chests, thighs, and loins for no other purpose than to avoid weakness and flabbiness and to become energetic. Another writer, Pomponius Mela said, Scythians tattoo their faces and limbs more or less in proportion to the prominence of their ancestors, and they do so in a way that the marks cannot be washed off. And these particular stories, as I said, of tattooed women are also well known. And, you know, there have been 7 Pazaric mummies found now, every single one of them tattooed. And the tattoos are, like, absolutely fascinating and beautiful in terms of their visual construction, right? So they are... I mentioned there when I was talking about this the rest of the grave goods, there was this yogurt spoon. Scythian, like, artifacts, and there was a really interesting exhibition at the British Museum a few years ago of Scythian treasures, basically everything from textiles to things like bronze work and metal work. There's this visual connection between all of these different styles. And essentially, it's kind of a bestiary, I think is the best way to describe it. There are these images which repeat in tattooing and across other forms of cultural art and artifactual practice, which are these almost like fantastical creatures, largely these interesting half... They get called griffins in the literature. They're almost like the top half of a horse with sort of kind of either antlers or some kind of mystical headdress thing, with their legs upside down.
Yeah.
In the literature on the art of the Scythian culture, this gets called the defeated pose, and it's sort of imagined that this is to indicate their mysticality, that these beings exist halfway between the spirit world and the real world. Although there are some archaeologists who've argued that Scythian horse riders often made their horses wear big headdresses and kind of decorative or even armor headdresses. And so these things that look mystical might actually, in some senses, be representations of the real horses. It's difficult to see how they work. But
yeah, and this is a question that I was about to ask, is that, like, is this kind of an inference of a kind of animist belief structure that might have been in the Scythian culture? Or, like you said, this is just a tattoo representation of a decorative culture. This is a question that is pervasive.
Yeah, well, it's you know, it's actually kind of pretty impossible to articulate that with any certainty. The actual I think the consensus amongst the people that study this in more detail and with more contextual knowledge than I have basically do think it is indicative of a kind of animistic belief system. There was an interesting article by a guy called Gala Argent back in 2013, which articulates these as particularly representative of a kind of relationship between the riders and their horses.
Yeah.
So that these are particularly to do with a culture which really prizes horse riding. Mm-hmm. I think the more conventional reading of this stuff is exactly as you said, as a kind of animistic account of a kind of fantastical bestiary that that is somehow linked to a broader set of belief systems. I mean, these are the things that sort of archaeological methods find very, very difficult to articulate. I mean, there are these fantastical griffin creatures in particular. But then there are things that are more obviously, like, realistic. One of the Pazaric bodies, not the princess herself, not the lady herself, actually has this incredible scene of, like, jaguars or big cats of some kind hunting, like, deer, and it's like a scene of a hunt, and it's absolutely bonkers good. Like, it's kind of like sick ass panther tattooing.
Yeah.
Right. In the mimetic language of the shitty tattoo subreddit. But 2,000 years in advance.
Hey, are you enjoying the show? If you really like Beneath the Skin and you want to help support us, you can do so on Patreon. For little as £5 a month, you can help make this show possible. Help us buy research materials. So if you like the show and you want to support us, consider kicking us a few quid a month. and you'll get everything from bonus episodes to Q&As, and you can even vote on what tattoo I'll get when we reach a certain subscriber count. Matt, have you got anything to say?
You should really definitely fund the Patreon, because tattoo history is massive, right? Deep, wide, complicated. We're covering some big hit topics on the main feed, but on the Patreon subscriber-only feed, we'll be getting into some really more interesting, niche, deep topics you don't want to miss out on. And honestly, the chance to kind of decide what Thomas gets on his body is probably just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Subscribe, chuck us a few quid. Don't miss out on the chance to ruin Thomas's body forever.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also really interesting to note, and we kind of mentioned it earlier on, the time at which this discovery happened, you're in a transition period between the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, all of these new burgeoning republics, and the Altai Princess kind of becomes a political football, an ethnographic football to be played with, and a political object.
Well, this is right. So you can hear there from, even in that very, very first magazine article written the year of the discovery, Paul Smax were already talking about this as loot, right? And also talking about DNA testing. So it's very, very clear, right? And the tattoos in particular articulate a very, very sophisticated, aesthetically advanced culture, right? Mm-hmm. Like they'd been written by the Greeks and their enemies in less aesthetically complementary terms than it turns out is available.
Certainly described as more savage than civilized.
Yeah, and discovered as you said at the very edges of the former Soviet Union in an independent republic. Called Altai. And so the DNA testing is done archaeologically, right, to figure out who this woman is and what her cultural context is. But it also becomes politicized, because what happens is her DNA analysis is used to justify Russian supremacy over the region in place of indigenous rights. So The first sort of round of DNA tests say, well, this woman is more genetically like, Russians than she is like indigenous Altai people. So your claims to the regional, supremacy over this part of the world are done away with. In return, or in response, this is why she is, I think, better known now and should be called, and I do in my book, call her Ochibala. Is that the Altai people like associate this body with a specific mythical figure from their folklore. So they are like, this is Ochibala. This is this folkloric figure. And she gets to embody a kind of Altai independence and an Altai lineage and a kind of relationship between their religious and spiritual and socio-cultural belief systems in that place, this particular place, as we said, in the pastures of heaven, which goes back thousands and thousands of years. But actually, like, the Russian scientists don't want to do that, right? They don't want to kind of see this as an ethnic republic. And actually, this is a particular kind of argument that's happening as the Russian Federation tries to figure out what it is, in almost in the same way as Japan was in the 1850s, like trying to work out how you make a kind of a contemporary nation state out of an ethnically diverse federation. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to do that is to try and claim some ethnic homogeneity. So the tattoos, I think, as I said, are really amazing. They include not just these griffin horses, but we have like wildfowl, big cats, fish. Another woman discovered in 1949 has, which is this one that was referred to earlier on, has like these three cats ambushing and devouring two antlered animals. one of the Pazurik people has a like little chicken on their thumb, and yeah, it's like it's just legible iconography, I think is the best way to put it, right? And of course, one of the reasons that sailors get tattooed too, right? Is that if you're a nomadic culture, it's easier to mark status and desire and taste and politics and belief with tattooing, which you haven't got to carry around, than it is to have objects of other kinds. So perhaps it's not a surprise, or shouldn't be a surprise, that this nomadic culture, which persists primarily on horseback, is so tattooed. And we should also say, actually, although she gets called and was called this princess, it's again, the current consensus is that she's some kind of shamanic figure or has some kind of spiritual, magico-religious praxis.
The thing that's quite unique about these tattoos is, from like a visual and a technical sense, how tightly packed all the ink is. Do we know what tools they were using at the time?
So, good question. This is something which is very controversial. There's an article in Aaron's book, or the book that Aaron and Lars Krutak edited, by an archaeologist who argues that, based on some findings from a different Scythian subgroup called the Sarmatians, they were basically these bronze needles, right? But actually, I think even Aaron and Lars themselves, and certainly other scholars of this part of the world, are not convinced that those needle complexes from Sarmatian culture are tattooing. They're more mainly because actually a lot of the needles in that culture that they've discovered have eyelets in them, and you know, so seem to be more for sewing than for tattooing. I think, yeah, we don't know really how they were tattooed. It does seem likely that they were poked. I think I'd be right in saying that. Aaron may correct me, but yeah, they're astonishing. Like, they're very graphic. They're black outline. As I said, they match stylistically the kind of designs that we find elsewhere. It's a very recognizable iconography. And really interestingly, at another Kurgan, and where several of these other mummies have been found, there's even a suggestion they were tattooed by the same person. So one tattooer has had several pieces of their work survive for a couple of thousand years.
Yeah, Jesus, most modern tattoo artists would eat their heart out for that. But I think it does make sense when you think about in terms of the social structure of a nomadic group that primarily travels through horseback. Generally, most of the roles would be quite specified because you would have limited capacity for the transportation of tools, etc. And obviously, generally at this time, people would be quite specialized in what they did. So it's not necessarily a surprise to say that they were done by one person, especially given the complexity of the designs and the application.
Right. But it's also interesting that there's such direct continuity that we might even presume that there was some kind of flash design almost, because these designs are very similar, you know, across individual bodies. I mean, it's also probably worth saying that it's clear that tattooing was not something that was only one social class. I mean, you talk about specified roles. So the bodies that we have show tattooing of people some kind of chieftain, the eldest man. Another is clearly a more ordinary warrior. No clear difference. I'm quoting for myself here. There's no clear difference between tattooing habits of men and women, although female mummies do not have tattooing on their legs. So it's a very, very interesting visual style. Archaeologists surmise that images are so consistent in style and so eloquently placed on the skin in concert with the flow of the wearer's body, the designs must have been drawn on the skin prior to being tattooed. This ancient master was not working freehand, but perhaps to some ancient equivalent of design sheets. right? Like this, they're not, they're, as you said, like the ink's packed in, but the designs are coherently put together. There's not, they're not kind of smashing this out freehand, it seems, by looking at these designs.
And it's also interesting as well that after this body was discovered, it was held in Novosibirsk, and we do have some kind of resolution to this relatively recently in the past 10 years.
This is right, and this is just sort of what I was talking about with someone the other day. So, over the course the discussions over the course of the DNA, these big sort of arguments about her ethno-nationalist positioning. Basically, the Altai, as over the course of the latter half of the 20th century. Altai indigenous politicians basically also banned the archaeology of the region, right? Because they're like, stop digging up our ancestors. This is literally part of, we do think this is part of heaven. Like, this is a sacred place. Like, stop your fucking digging, guys. And there were also, of course, then, particularly since the early 2000s, there's been, as there has been all over the world, calls for repatriation of bodies, right? So, return of objects, artifacts, and human remains to the places that they're actually from. And yeah, the Ochibala's body was no exception. But of course, like, so actually this is what one Altai indigenous politician said. Sometimes it's difficult to openly talk about politics. So we use her as a metaphor to discuss the difficult position of Altaians in Russia. Claiming her is claiming our land. And on the one hand, a very positive post-colonial account is that a brand new museum was built near to where she was discovered. And that's where her body is now. It was returned to this specialist-built museum of Altai culture and history, out of which her body is the central, most important piece of a thing in the museum collection. The horrible twist and the really kind of cynical twist of this is that museum was paid for by Gazprom, the Kremlin affiliated oil company.
Yeah, right,
this is what gets called the necropolitics of this, because I suppose you might imagine, if you have a kind of instinctive idea about how these things work, that like the Gazprom would take the Russian nationalist view on this. But of course, they also pragmatically need to dig oil pipelines across this region. And with indigenous autonomy in the area, in the region, getting permits to dig oil pipelines was not going to be possible without indigenous politicians signing off on it. And so that leads to this completely cynical appropriation of indigenous rights movements, of post-colonial museum conversation, these things that are being really, really hot in my, in my discipline in art history and museum studies, to once again be a tool of oil capitalism, right? So the Gazprom were like, if you let us dig an oil pipeline across this region, we will pay for the museum, and we'll also politically smooth the return of this body to this region. Like, it's the most like cynical.
Yeah, but it's also interesting in the sense of, like, this occurred in 2012 and was kind of a phantom of what was to come in terms of, like, at this point it was like Russian soft cultural power, in also done through business, like, you know, like, Gazprom needs to build a pipeline, we'll give you back this body that has like a spiritual and cultural and historical significance. And then 2 years later they invade Crimea, and now obviously there is a war going on at the Ukrainian border, and in Ukraine it kind of, Russia went a bit mask off. They decided that, yeah, well, we could build museums, but we could also just conscript prisoners.
Yeah, well, and funny, this is the title of the best article of this history is actually called "Exceptions to Authoritarianism." right? By a social theorist called, oh, social political theorist called Gert-Jan Pletz. Exceptions to authoritarianism, variegated sovereignty, and ethno-nationalism in a Siberian resource frontier, from 2019. And yeah, this is literally by Pletz's argument and an exception to authoritarianism, right? Like, it's kind of a weird particular example. And he says, encoded in most studies of identity politics in contemporary Russia is a prevalent image that the Kremlin treats culture as a zero-sum game, where only carefully curated images of the nation-state are allowed. We talked about, I think, a similar issue when we talked about Chinese tattooing in the story of Wei Fei, whose tattoos also don't fit very neatly into a ethno-nationalist story of contemporary China. So, yeah, but.
Also, like, where does this leave the question then in terms of, like, repatriation of cultural objects back to places? Like, obviously, the British Museum comes under a lot of justified heat for objects that they display and hold, that they should be returned. But, like, where does this leave that question then?
Well, I think this is a really specific example, right? Like, I don't think, for example, the return of Toimoko tattooed heads from Maori people, for example, back to New Zealand, or the return of Native American artifacts to tribal ancestral communities in the United States, like, the stakes are a bit different. But of course it is the case that business is going to cynically exploit these kind of things for its own good. And actually, particularly where you've got a kind of ethno-nationalist articulation, and I think you do see this actually a little bit in the Greek, or some of the conversations that have happened in the conversation about the Parthenon marbles have been kind of, you know, inflected by problematic right-wing nationalist identity claims, but that's not to say that the claims, the return, shouldn't happen. Like, I don't think the fact that Gazprom paid for this means it shouldn't have happened, actually, but it's obviously not. It's very good that and important that indigenous culture is celebrated and but of course these things are always going to be subject to dominant hegemonic power structures, unfortunately. Right. I mean, it even happens. I mean, you even see it, for example, in the way that, like, the Belgian state have talked about their own imperial crimes in the Congo. There's been lots of academic scholarship on, you know, supposedly post-colonial scholarship or museology in places like Belgium, which actually are still not good enough. You know, same is true for, you know, the way slavery is talked about in the United States and in Britain, where the abolition story of "Aren't we great?" Is much more dominant than the story of the crimes committed. So, yeah, it's these things are very, very complicated. But I just think I do use the example of Ochibala's body now as a really good example of, like, the complexity of this issue, because I think that the top line always at the beginning of these topics is, yeah, good, hey, indigenous rights, like post-colonial museum theory, you know, but actually what we're ending up with is something that is still cynically, you know, appropriated. Pletz actually says, like, at the end of his article, future comparative research is imperative as there are other regions in Russia where minorities or alternative subcultures receive freedoms that others are struggling for. Preliminary insights from the high north signal that states of exceptions are popular instruments of government in authoritarian states. Right. So actually this kind of, like, state of exception is a really important and interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we're going to leave it there for... and with that in mind, I want to thank everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more like it, check out our Patreon for as little as £3 a month. You can get extra episodes. We're currently doing our Ink Master watch along. Matt is really excited about it. But we also have some higher tiers as well. At £5, you get 2 extra episodes per month and you get episodes early. At £15, you get a copy of Matt's book, Painted People, signed, sent directly to you, sealed with a kiss. But we also want to thank our £10 and above patrons. So that's the £10, the £15. You get a shout out directly from us. So without further ado, I want to thank Stephen McCann, Morpheus Ravenna, Chris Block, Shit Jesus, Kirsten Wright, Kathleen Burkhardt, James Schick, and Charlie Lightning. Thank you to all of you. And thank you to everyone who listens to the show. If you don't have the cash, I know times are a bit tight at the moment. You can help us out by leaving a review or sharing your favorite episode with a friend. And make sure to follow us on Instagram as well. We are running a giveaway. You can win a £400 voucher for Darren Quinn at Leather Lane. And check us out at Beneath Skin Pod on Instagram. And without further ado, it's thank you from me, Tom.
And thank you from me. As always, I'm going to try and give some quick references, and we'll try and do some written ones as well. Actually, my book, Painted People, has a whole set of footnotes on this topic, so you can go and look that up. Ancient Ink is very, very good. There is also a really, really great exhibition catalogue from the British Museum, which has a whole... did have some preserved tattooed skins in it, but they also basically it shows you lots and lots of the visual culture of the Scythians. The book was called Scythians, Warriors of Ancient Siberia, so you can pick that up if you're really interested in knowing more about this culture, get my book, look at the footnotes for the more technical academic history stuff as well.
Bye.
Bye.